welcome to another episode of the Semi-Pro Poker Show. It is April 19th, 2016, and unfortunately we're way behind with what our planned schedule is. Sorry that I had to take an extra week after saying that we're going to be week to week, which we still are. That is the plan. And the ideal day that I wanted to post these episodes was on Sunday evenings, or maybe Sunday afternoons, or at some point like that. And unfortunately, I had a 60-hour work week this past week at my day job. So unfortunately, I had to spend extra time over there and actually had to take a whole week off from even playing poker. I didn't get back to the table until Sunday. But anyway, good to have you with us again as we take this next step in our journey to becoming a poker professional. So, like I said, I took a week off from playing. I did not take a week off from learning new things. I also made a post on the Facebook page that I hope people checked out. I made a couple, but the main thing was that I posted a hand that I played a couple of weeks ago, and I wanted to get some feedback on what some of you listeners thought about the hand up to a certain point, and then I was going to reveal what I ended up doing and why. So I think this is going to be a new segment. I think I'm going to try and incorporate this every week, maybe like the hand of the week. You know, I'll take all my hands together. I tend to take my hands down in notes anyway, which everybody should be doing, by the way. This wasn't even a planned part of my script or a planned part of the show, but you should be taking notes down of hands you play, and not just, quote, interesting ones where, I don't know, you get check raised in a massive pot and you don't know if you're being bluffed or not. Like, those hands are important, there's no doubt about it, but there are some small things that you can pick up on that maybe you'll be making, that maybe there are mistakes that you are making. So it really is dependent on you, but I highly encourage everyone to take notes. And I don't mean like pen and paper. I've seen some people take pen and paper to actual games and start writing hands down, but they're not even like writing like hands in terms of skill. They're just writing like hands they're dealt. I don't know what any of that does. Like, you're going to get the same amount of hands as everyone else does over the long run. So seeing what hands you're dealt with in like a certain order, you're just going to drive yourself crazy trying to find something that just isn't there. You know, the math is just, in the long run, it's equal to everyone. I'm going to get dealt the same amount of pocket aces that you are. And I'm going to get dealt the same amount of jack deuce offsuit that you are. In the long run, it doesn't matter. So if anyone's doing anything like that, just stop. Just do yourself a favor. Stop doing that right now. excuse me. There's tip number one. Doing anything like that is just, you're going to drive yourself crazy. But anyway, so if you look on the Facebook page, I posted this particular hand. It was from a 1-2 No Limit Underground game that I played. And this hand is important because it kind of shows the deeper thought process that you can have that can kind of get you below the surface level of hands. Like for example, you generally hear advice like, if a tight player raises and your hand is not strong, you should fold. You know, it's something more like, it's just generic advice. And the point of becoming a good poker player is being able to get past all of that noise, being able to make sure you're thinking individually in every situation, because it always depends. Nothing is ever the same. So anyway, I'm going to read this hand real quick, and I got plenty of responses too, so thank you all. I do read every response, and please continue to do that as we move forward. I love feedback. Feedback, like I said in the first episode, is going to help drive the show. It lets me know that what I'm doing is, you know, people are enjoying what I'm doing, or at least listening and tuning in. And it's also going to help create new content for the site. It's also going to help keep it interactive, which is all super important, I'd say. All right, so moving along here. Underground 1-2 game in Virginia. About 4 hours into the session, seven-handed. Game plays pretty deep. There's lots of regs every week, but most aren't very good, and this is just true. This game is one of the best 1-2 games I've ever played. Everyone there is really nice. They're all friends with each other. Lots of regs in terms of everybody comes back every week. It's kind of on a scheduled basis, and it's a great game. I have fun with it. It's one of my favorite games I have ever played in my life, and at least home games for sure. The host is great. He built his own table with like LED lighting surrounding the table. It's really, the chips are quality is nice. Provides things. I mean, it's a great environment, and it's one of a kind because most games like that, not only are they going to be raked, but they're going to be raked, you know, decently high if there's no competition from casinos in the area. That's why you'll notice with some home games in cities or states where there are no casinos allowed, there's lots of home games, but the rake tends to be high because they don't have to compete with casinos. You can still rake too high and kill your game, but in some instances, you can get away with a higher rake because you're not competing with, you know, most casinos like 1-2s and 2-5s where their max rake is $5 or $6, you know, and then maybe their bad beat jackpot, which adds another dollar or something. They don't have to compete with that. So this game is one of a kind. There's no doubt about it. Hero, that's us. Whenever I'm going to post a hand in the, and whenever any of you post a hand, and I highly encourage you to do so, that's what the wall is for. It's for all of us to post. Whenever you post a hand, just put yourself as hero. Okay, whenever people post poker hands, for whatever reason, hero is you, and villain is your opponent. It's funny how that works, just the way it's always worked. Under the gun plus two with $530. I love my description of myself. Mid-20s white kid, because skin color is relevant, I guess. It's not really. Tight aggressive player. Well-respected at this particular game. Shows down good winning hands most of the time. Rarely gets caught bluffing. Really good image. Have been winning tonight as well. These are important factors. If you're showing down good hands, not only if you're winning, but if you seem like you're just playing well and running over the table, people will mess with you less. They can give you the ability to then maybe make more moves because people are going to play back at you less because they're so, you know, you have that image of strength. You have that really strong winning image. And that's really important. Villain is MP1, $420. And he's a good, and he's a friend of mine. I really like Villain. Early 40s white guy, again, with my racial stereotypes. If you go to a casino, I'm just going to be honest with you, and you're playing with unknown people, then to be quite honest, you're just going to have to, before you develop reads, you basically have to go on stereotypes. Not like racial stereotypes, but how people play. Like, if you sit down with a young Asian guy with lots of money, generally what a lot of people think is that he could be tend to be more aggressive. If you're playing with a old white guy, they tend to be really, really, really tight. If you play with a mid-30s black person, they tend to be gambly. Not necessarily aggressive, but willing to go on draws. This is not a racist thing. This is just what people... And there's one for everybody. Those are just some that I hear. I don't really go necessarily on that. I kind of focus more on how much do they have in front of them, how much, you know, are they shuffling chips around, do they look focused, are they relaxed. Those are more the things I go on because I find the racial stereotypes in terms of trying to develop reads on unknowns just to be false so much of the time, and you can't rely on that. Not to mention it just kind of feels wrong. But that's a whole nother debate. I don't like doing it, but sometimes you have to go with whatever information that you have. Okay? All right, so we're going to back to the description. He raises preflop with a super tight range. I mean, I'm talking ace-king and jacks plus. Sometimes he'll even limp some of these big hands. He's not the strongest player post-flop. And what I mean by that, let's say he opens queens and it comes queen 9-4 with two spades. So he flops a top set, and he has three people in the hand, and the pot's about $80. He'll bomb like $100 to $150 into that flop with top set to defend his hand against like flush draws or straight draws. Like, he'll just take the pot down now. He's one of those kind of players. At this game, he's probably a small winning player. I don't think he's a loser, but his inability to play post-flop certainly hurts his win rate massively. So, that's the kind of guy he is. All right, so onto the hand. Like I said, seven-handed. I'm under the gun plus one. And the button straddles for $5. Small blind calls. Folds around a hero who has king of diamonds, queen of clubs. The suits are relevant in this hand. And I raise to $18. I'm kind of ISOing the fishy players on the button and the small blind. They're not very strong players. They've been straddling all night. So if I raise a straddle here, and even if I miss, if the board's good, then I can take down this pot a lot when they just fold. For example, let's say I open king, queen, and they both call. And the board comes out deuce, deuce, six. Or six, six, deuce. Or ace, three, three. I can take down that pot a significant portion of the time because they're not repping strong hands when they limp and then essentially limp again with the straddle. The button defends his straddle with a wide range. He's in there with so many hands, so he's going to miss the flop a lot. And then the small blind has already limped. If he calls, what strong hands is he repping? I mean, he could have an ace, sure, but one, is it's not going to be a very strong ace, and two, if I recognize that he possibly has an ace, can he handle three streets of value if I decide to barrel this hand? Let's say I c-bet bluff the flop. He calls. Turn is a blank. Pot's now $70, and I bet 50. Is he really going to then call eight, like ace three? And then let's say the river comes a queen, and I just bomb $150. Sorry, I got my dogs playing with toys right here. Is he going to call with just an ace there after limping? I mean, some players will, but I think this player, he kind of recognizes strength for the most part, and he'll fold. Not to mention, when I have that winning image, he might not even call past the flop, you know? So it's really relevant to recognize these factors. These are the things that I think about, and I'm just kind of giving you an initial tidbit into my thought process. And then as we move forward and the more concepts we talk about, the more and more I'll open my mind up in particular. But I'm kind of giving you the initial brief description. Okay. So I made it 8-15 with the idea of isolating the button and the small blind, who will call straddles a lot and then just fold when they miss. Villain to my immediate left, who I described in the hand, flats. So, and then the button and small blind both call. This is interesting. He, like I said, he can tend to flat with a lot of stuff. He can slow play, but he can also call with some weaker hands here too. Here's another interesting tidbit. It's late in the night in a home game. This game usually lasts about 6 hours, maybe a little bit less, and or about 5.5. Here's an interesting thing that I think happens almost exclusively to home games compared to the casinos. Home games are only going to be going for a certain amount of time. So if players recognize that the end of the night is coming, at the end of the session, and especially if they're down, you might see players, especially ones that are loose, start playing more hands to try and make up for their losses because they only have, let's say there's an hour left in the game. They essentially are trying to force the issue that, hey, if I play more hands, maybe I can make a comeback. And we all know, or at least we all should know, that you can't force this. Poker really is one long session. Let's be quite honest. It's one long session that you're always playing. All you are accumulating are hours. It is different that at the casino, you can essentially leave whenever you want, as long as the casino is a populated one in terms of games always running. But in terms of forcing the issue, you really shouldn't do that because there's always another game. So let's say you're down $80 and there's one more hour left in the home game. I've recognized myself doing this before I started to really start to learn poker, but if you've noticed yourself trying to like play more hands because it's almost the night's almost over and I got to make up more money, just think about it like this. Do you do the same thing when you're winning or if you're losing at a casino? Do you, because at a casino you can get up whenever you want. But think about it. If you're playing 5 hours at a home game and 5 hours at a casino, what's really the difference? If you force yourself to play more hands at the end of the night, you're making more mistakes and you're costing yourself money because if you're making more mistakes, then you're going to lose more often. That's just simply the reality. If you make more mistakes, you're going to lose more often. You're forcing the issue. You really shouldn't be worried about individual sessions and making sure that, oh, I have to win by the end of the night. Because hours are hours. If you play well in a certain amount of time frame, the fact that you maybe lost one night in a 5-hour session doesn't mean you're going to lose regardless sometimes. So if you force the issue, you're costing yourself money by not playing well. You're playing worse when you do that. You can't force these hands to just work. And that's what I've noticed. Some people try and do. They'll try and get involved in more pots the other night, even some tight players. Anyway, that's what this guy actually can do sometimes. And it is late in the night, but he's up a decent amount. We're both, you know, we're going to the flop for 200 big blinds deep plus. And the button and small blind both have about 300 in front of them. So roughly the effective stack size is in between $350. But I just want you to keep note of that, y'all. If you do that, stop. Some nights with your losing sessions, maybe your goal should be to just minimize losses. Don't compound mistakes. Because that's what you're doing when you're trying to force a win happen when you're going to lose or not. The hands are just going to happen. I've had sessions where I've entered the last few hands of a home game, and I'm down 200, and I'm not prepping to try and find some way to make that up in two hands, but maybe I got dealt set over set, and I stacked somebody in the end of the night. Like, it's going to happen naturally. But in the meantime, you should be focused on playing well and minimizing your mistakes, and playing more at the end of the game, because the game's almost over, and you're losing or winning, and you're just trying to make up for whatever it is you're trying to do, then you're doing it wrong. And you're costing yourself a significant portion of your win rate by doing that. I promise you, that is one of the biggest mistakes that people make in home games in particular, and they probably don't even realize it. All right, I'm just thinking of the times where I've punted part of my stack away at the end of the night just because I was trying to make something happen that you just can't force. I know I'm kind of really, really emphasizing this too much at this point. So just wanted to make sure that you hammer that in. If you ever have any questions about that, please, I'm open to the discussion. Like, home game theory is something that's not discussed enough. And I think that's an interesting concept. All right. So we're going four ways to the flop. The pot's around $72. And the board comes out ace, jack, 10, all clubs. Okay, so we flop Broadway. And we have the queen of clubs, so we have the second nut flush draw, and we have a royal flush draw. So we flop good, there's no doubt about that. Small blind checks. Here's the thing. This isn't really a nuttish hand of the fact that we didn't flop like the nut flush. We did flop a good hand, and I'll see some people just check here. I see this all the time. Or they'll do something that just looks suspicious. Think about it. If you open king-queen, let's say this came out rainbow, and you open king-queen, comes ace-check-10 rainbow, and you flop the nuts. It checks to you. Why? What do you think someone's going to think, an opponent is going to think, if you check here, they bet, you call, and then all of a sudden you get crazy on the turn, or you check-raise the flop? That looks planned, right? It looks super strong. So why would you do that? Why would you try and go away from keeping your hand kind of balanced in a sense? Where if you're continuation betting, you're doing this with a bunch of different hands, not just the nuts. So people are going to be able to hand read less. They're going to be able to make more mistakes against you. But if you do something like a check and then you check raise the flop, or you just call and then bomb the turn to try and build a pot now. It looks planned. It looks forced. It looks like you have a hand that you have. And it really is that simple. Slow playing, to me, except against certain opponents, is generally just not profitable anymore. I think people have become smart enough, even some of the worst players, to realize that, not the worst players, but some of the less, you know, the small loser players have started to realize that a check raise on the turn, you know, especially one that's big sizing, you know, is strong. They're not going to stack off with one pair all that much anymore. It still happens, and if you know a player who does that, then by all means. But in general, you want to build pots with the good hands that you do get. So that's why, to me, fast playing is the way to go. That's where you're going to make a significant portion of money. It's by fast playing, by building pots. All right? I know we're taking long. I'm going to move along with this hand because there's other concepts I want to get to before we wrap up today. All right, so it checks to me, and I bet 22. And this you could argue, is a mistake. I do have a reason for why I bet so small. I bet like a third of the pot. Not even a third, a little less than a third. You could really argue, and I tend to agree, if I had bet like 30 here, is it really that much of a difference? Probably not. Or even 35. It's probably not, but the reason I bet so small is this board is so scary to so many people that if you bet something like $40, $50, and this is what I was telling two of my good friends whose games I really respect, that if you bet a larger sizing, even though it's only, let's say you bet half the pot at two-thirds of the pot, some people don't look at bet sizing, especially in home games or in live low stakes, no limit. They don't look at sizing like that in relation to pot. They look at it in absolute dollars. They're looking at, man, I have to call $50 with just my ace on a super scary all club board. Man, I don't know if I want to do that. Do you see what I mean? And say you bet the pot, I have to call $70 with my ace king on an ace-jack-10 all-club board? I don't know. Dogs, shut up. Sorry, y'all. I got all sorts of distractions going on. So that's why I bet small. I want to try and keep these hands involved. I know I just made the whole slow playing argument. I'm not slow playing here. I am trying to build a pot, and I am betting into three other people. But at the same time, it's not really slow playing. It's important to try and keep people in. I'm also trying to bet a sizing that they won't necessarily be scared of. Maybe I can get a couple streets of value now, you know, because I'm betting so small. But is there really a difference between $22 and $30 and maybe even $35? Probably not. I probably could bet more, and that's the mistake I think I made in this hand, is just betting so small on the flop. I think that was a little misguided, but I think the idea behind it is correct. But Kurt went a little small. So as I was saying, this is a super scary board to a lot of players, so betting smaller might get calls from 9x, you know, 9x of clubs, you know, or two pair. I conceded in my post, could definitely bet larger, probably should, but folds will happen so often that this sizing could maybe get calls most often. All right, now the villain in this hand makes it $50. He kind of thinks about it and then essentially makes a min raise. The button and the small blind both fold and it gets back to me. $28 to call in a pot of 140. I'm getting 5 to 1 in pot odds exactly. What do we do? So far, in a nutshell, I've been raised by a tight player. I've been raised by a guy who is not that active. And he is winning tonight. And he respects me. He respects my game a lot. For example, I've gotten him to fold bottom set with one raise on a flop before. Like, he's... And although I had top two pair and I was completely overplaying my hand, I guess, as it turned out, even though I thought he had more of an overpair in that particular spot. But I tend to get folds from him a lot. He respects my game. He knows that I study the game. He knows I'm a consistent winner, all that sort of stuff. So in a nutshell, it's like, okay, he's repping made hands here then. A tight player has just raised you on a scary board. It's time to get out. Let's look at it closer, though. If he's afraid of me, is he really going to raise ace-jack, ace-10 on this board with a min raise? On a scary board. Is he really going to min raise that? I don't... God damn it, dogs!
Go away.
I'm working. Go away. Sorry, y'all. So, is he really going to raise ace-jack, ace-10? I mean, maybe... But I think he would take more time. He kind of raised pretty quickly. I think he would take a little more time with it. But I'll give you that. Let's say maybe he could do that. Okay. What about... Someone said... Someone asked me, well, he could have the nut flush. But let's look at the board distribution. The ace of clubs, the jack of clubs, and the ten of clubs are all out there. And I have the queen of clubs. So are you telling me that a tight player is going to call my raise to my immediate left with king 9 of clubs? With king 8 of clubs? I've seen him play suited connectors, but I have never seen a tight player play a quadruple gapper. You know, 10-jack queen, 10-jack king, all in between. 10-jack queen, all in between the 9 and the king. It's a triple gapper. That just... Or a quadruple gapper. That just does not happen. I don't see that very often at all. And I already told you that with his nuttish hands, he'll either slow play or he'll bomb. Like, he might think that I have a set in this spot if he had, like, king X of clubs, and he might make it 100 and say, well, I just wanted you to fold your set so you didn't make a full house. That's literally what he does. So I think we can eliminate king X of clubs or anything like that. So that means that our queen of clubs has equity against his whole entire range. Okay? We have nine clean... Well, we have nine outs against... Well, if he has a flush, then we have seven outs. But if he has ace-jack, ace-10, even if he has a set, we have nine outs. But again... He would probably act, he would probably take his time with those types of hands. It's a scary board. It's me he's playing against, who he respects, and folds lots of hands to. So I kind of immediately weighed his range a lot towards smaller flushes. That's what I made my, if you add all that information together, and this is why it's important to pay attention. This is a lot of information, and we're going to go over this type of stuff bit by bit in future episodes, but it's important to take all this information to it into account because it can help you make your decisions much easier. So against made flushes, I have seven clean outs. You know, if you do the 4x2, 4x2 rule, that's what you do on the flop when you estimate your equity. You count how many outs you think you have, which in my case I believe is seven, and you multiply it by four. That gives you a 28% chance. It's probably not 28%, it's probably like 26 or 29 or 27. It's somewhere in the ballpark, but it's close enough. The rule gets you within a few decimal, within a few percentage points. It's always within like 2 percentage points. It's pretty accurate. And right now my pot odds are 5-1. So that means I have to hit my hand 1 out of 6 times, 5 scenarios where I don't and 1 scenario where I do. And that is a break-even scenario. That's what pot odds are. We haven't even gotten into the implied odds portion, which is where you're really going to make your money. But in terms of just normal pot odds, I need to be good 1 out of 6 times. That's less than 20%. So the fact that our winning percentage of 28% is higher than the amount we need it to be in order to be break-even, this is the easiest call in the world. All right, so I call. All right, I'm looking for a club, essentially. I'm getting the proper odds to call. All right, and just keep that stuff in mind because And also be open to plans changing, because my plan is going to change mid-hand. This is something that doesn't happen very often. When it does, you just have to be paying attention. And this is the stuff that's going to help you out, all right? Okay. So, why is my... Sorry, my notes app is kind of screwing up. Anyway, the turn is the red 10, okay? So it's the 10 of diamonds. So the board is ace, jack, 10, all clubs, and the turn is the 10. The board is now paired. I check. Villain looks perplexed. Doesn't look like it's a Hollywood either. He looks a little perplexed. And bets 50 again. I posted this option in the Facebook post as well. I explained my thought process on the flop and explained what happened on the turn. And this is where most people, I think, made their mistake. They said either they thought I was ahead, or they thought that I should just call, you know, to either try and hit a club or yada yada, which I understand from a general viewpoint, I get, but this is where you need to be able to think outside the box. Is this guy going to bet ace-jack on the turn? When the 10 now pairing in an all-club board, and he can't have the ace or jack of clubs because they're both out there on the flop, is he going to bet ace-jack on the turn? I think we can all say the answer is no. A tight player against me, he's going to check that 100% of the time. We can eliminate that from his range. Is he going to bet ace-10 this way when he improves to a full house? Probably not. I could see him checking it or maybe Hollywooding and making some sort of bet. But is he going to bet 50 again? No. No. What this bet kind of means to me is someone who is confused. They don't know what they're supposed to do, but they feel like they're kind of supposed to bet, but they're confused on sizing. So they're just going to bet and just kind of hope it works. It's like I'm calling them like throw it to the wall and hope it sticks kind of bet. You know? Like it's just they're confused. It's a confused bet. I think that's what I'm going to call it. Confused bet. They feel like they're supposed to bet, they don't know the sizing and they don't know why they're betting. So what kind of hands would be confused here? We've already eliminated King X of clubs from his range because we know he doesn't play hands like that. Even at the end of the night, and he's winning. He has no reason to get involved in a pot with me with King 8 or King 7 of clubs. I've never seen him ever turn over a hand like that. So would he continue to bet a suited connector, you know, type of like a small flush, like a 5-6 of clubs, a 7-8 of clubs, a 3-4 of clubs? Would he bet that? I could potentially see that. I could also see him checking because of the board pairing on the turn. But would he bet large with that? I don't think so. Because he should against a player like me. I think he should be betting that larger there. But again, I told you that he's not that skilled pre-flop or post-flop. So if his hand is down to that, what can we do? What options do we have? Like I said on the flop, we can call. We're getting even better pot odds now. We're getting almost 5-1 again. You know, we're getting just under 5-1. You know, when I call on the flop, it's 190, and then he bets 50. That's 240, 50 for me to call. Go away. Stop biting each other. I'm getting almost 5-1 again. I'm getting immediate pot odds again. And I'm getting a little under pot odds, but in terms of implied odds, I'm doing just fine with 7 clean outs. And that's just what's important. This is where it's important to think about other things. Can we take another line? I went back to the preflop and I told you he respects me and I've gotten him to fold lots of hands. Can we check raise here? How strong does that look? How strong does a check raise look? That I raised preflop, I bet on the flop, he raised, and I called anyway. Turn pairs the board. I check, he bets again, and I now check raise. What hands does it look like I have? Do you kind of get what I'm getting at? What hands does it look like I have? How strong do I look? I look pretty fucking strong, if you ask me. That looks like a full house a lot. You know, does it make sense for me to ever have King X of Clubs here? No, but are some people who aren't good at hand reading going to think that? No, they're just good at finding monsters under the bed, and that's what he can do. I told you he's a small winning player, but he folds way too much, especially to me in these spots. Because I can show up with a hand like a full house. Not to mention, really, when you think about it, with all the hands I continue on with, the worst hand that I can show up here with is probably this hand. I mean, theoretically, if I had a hand like Ace-King, if I had like Ace-King off with the King of Clubs, I probably would do the same thing. But even then, a hand like that has equity against a hand like his, which I think to be is a small flush. So these are the worst hands that we show up with. Sorry about that. I had my dogs just going fucking bonkers. Anyway, so as I was saying, if you check raise here, this is the worst hand I show up with, or ace king with the King of Clubs, and I have equity with both of those hands, or I show up with the full house, or quads. I show up with quad tens, I show up with jacks full, aces full, and tens full of aces, or tens full of jacks. That's just what I'm going to show up with here. Does it make sense for me to have those hands a lot of the time? No, but is that what I'm representing against somebody who's not going to hand read that much? Or hand read that well? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, knowing me, against him, I'm probably folding like any two pair on the flop, but am I folding sets? Probably not. Am I folding the nut flush draw? Probably not. So, even with the hands that I know that I'll show up with, I'm doing decently well. So, the fact that I can do that, I also need to make sure I leave, let's say I do check raise, I need to leave a lot of money behind in order for me to bluff the river. Like, let's say I check raise to 150, and he thinks about it and he calls. He'll have over 250 left. That's a significant bet that he would then have to call on the river. He would have to call a really large bet, a shove, essentially, on the river. So I did decide to check raise. I thought it was the best play. It looked strong, and I also want to make sure that I'm bluffing with the least amount possible to get the job done. That's what it takes to be a success, to have a successful bluff. You need to make sure you're doing it with the least amount of money that you need to do it in order to succeed. So I made it 125. One, I'm relying on the fact that the bluff itself looks strong, so I don't have to bet that much. And then two, I'm leaving $275 to $300 that he then has to call on the river if he decides to call here on the turn. And that would be one hell of a call against me, a player he respects, with, say, 5-4 of clubs. That I check raise and then bomb the river. That's a hell of a call. And it's a really tough spot. And I still have equity. If a club rolls off on the river, I can value bet and try and get called by a worse flush. So I think this plan is by far the best plan for this hand, but a lot of people wouldn't recognize that. They would just look in a vacuum and say, well, this is a tight player who has raised you on the flop and has now bet the turn. You should fold, or you should just call and try and hit your club. You have to be able to look outside the box. You have to be able to find new ways to win. And it kind of works in reverse, too. Some people might say, well, you have to call because nothing changed on the river. And if you think somebody's bluffing, then you have to call. Not true. You have to think about it smartly and intelligently and logically to come to the best decision. Okay? So I check raise, and instantly he says, I knew I had you on the flop until that turn card, and he mucks 5-6 of clubs face up. I mean, I don't think I'm a genius, But I think what I am good at and what my skills have developed is going beyond all that noise, all that generic strategy, and thinking about different factors in one hand that can help you find what you perceive to be the best decision. Generic strategy is good. You know, it'll improve your win rate if you're a loser. It'll help make you a potential winner if you are a loser. But becoming a really good player means you have to go beyond those boundaries. You have to be able to move. You have to be able to maneuver your way through hands, even change a plan you may have for a hand if a new door opens up. And I think his mistake was that sizing on the turn. It makes absolutely no sense for him to have a strong hand. And believe it or not, 5-6 of clubs on an ace-jack-10-10 board with three clubs is not a strong hand. Especially if I check raise. That is a bluff catcher. I either have the nuts or I'm bluffing. It's one of the two things. It is not a strong hand. So, that wraps up that hand. So, I just wanted to let you know that was the results. I did end up winning. So, for any of you who are rooting for me, congrats. You got your wish. I'm sure I'll go over some hands of the week where I lose. Actually, I know I'll go over hands of the week where I lose. But the key notes to take away from that is, one, these are some of the things I think about in a hand. And this was a pretty deep thought process. Usually you can make quicker decisions than this. And of course, when I'm thinking, you're able to think through things much quicker than you're able to speak. Because I know this hand took like 30 minutes to go over. But in terms of hand reading, in terms of being able to change your plan, in terms of going beyond generic strategy and going based on tells. For example, I told you that he didn't look too comfortable. He looked a little confused. These are relevant factors, and all you have to do is pay attention. This information is everywhere in every game, and I still struggle with paying attention. I'm on my phone way too much. I've gotten a lot better at it, but do I still think there is massive improvement for myself to make or for me to make? Yes. And if you put your phone down and realize that, hey, you're playing for money, you're trying to win, and there's information available to you throughout the game that can help you win, then why would you throw that away? To look at a Facebook post, to scroll through Instagram, or check ESPN for scores for teams that you're not even really rooting for, which I know I do. I can check a score for, like, you know, Golden State and Houston. I don't care. I like to see history, but I don't care. I'm not a fan of either of those two teams. Why does it matter? This matters. This is immediate, and I can control this. Other factors, I simply cannot. So, that's all important. That's a glimpse into my thought process. We'll delve into more specific areas as we go along. But I know I've taken up a lot of time with this hand, and generally the hand reviews are not going to be that long. But I just wanted to make sure all the information we had was available. I'm going to run through some little things here. This is the, you know, second portion of the episode. These are little things that I view good professional cash game players that a lot of them do, and some of them do not. But these are not necessarily even strategy tidbits in terms of playing a hand, but these are important meta game things that you can do that can help keep your game going, especially if you're in a home game where your player pool is limited. This is super important. You need to understand that not only are you going to lose from time to time, it's paramount that you lose from time to time. What I mean by that is it is important for the poker ecosystem that bad players win occasionally. It's that winning feeling, going home with money, in some cases lots of money, that brings a losing player back to play again. Not that you should throw a game away. Hell no. I'm talking about how when you get, let's say you get all in as an 80% favorite against a 20%. Like, you get it all in preflop with aces against jacks. It's generally like an 80-20. It's right around there. That it's good that that 20% exists, because that's when a bad player will win and come back and continue to get in situations like that. You want those compounding 80% equities are going to make you massive amounts of money in the long run, but it's important to keep a bad player coming back. It's good. It's a good thing. It's something I've learned to embrace. The little run bad situations where, you know, a bad player who's, you know, who, you know, doesn't win very often, likes to win, tries to win, but plays bad, so they're not going to win. They're going to keep coming back and keep dumping money into your, you know, what you're in, into your income. So instead of getting mad when you lose on a suckout, and I used to get mad. Some of my friends who were listening to this podcast know how much of a fucking asshole I could be years ago when I would lose on a bad beat, that it could just send me on tilt for the entire night. Instead, what I've learned to understand is just because you're an 80% favorite does not mean that you're supposed to win. Like, you're entitled to winning that hand. You own, let's say the pot's $200, you own 80% of that pot, or $160. That's your equity stake in that pot. Your opponent has $40 for 20%. The weird thing about poker is that people don't take shares. They don't take equity stake out of a pot. You either win 100% of the pot or you lose. You get none of it. And so really, when you win as an 80% favorite, you're running above expectation. You're only supposed to get 80% of that pot, but you got 100. Does that make sense? You're actually running good by gaining an extra 20% equity in a pot that you're not supposed to have. Let that sink in, and the next time you lose on a bad beat, even if you initially get upset, I want you to think about that. That's why poker is amazing. That's why it's sustainable. Because bad players are going to win their 20% stake sometimes. 20% of the time. And it's good because that's what keeps them coming back and giving you, the good player, money. That's how you make your living. It's important. So stop getting upset over it. If you're on a cooler, if you're just on a downswing, I can get that it can be frustrating. I completely understand that. But you know, if you keep playing good, the downswings will be much smaller and much less infrequent than your upswings. And your losses in sessions will be smaller than your wins in your winning sessions. It's just a fact. So it's paramount that you understand this, because if you don't, if you get entitlement tilt, which is, I should win so many of these pots, but I'm losing, you will drive yourself insane. You will drive yourself absolutely mad. And it's important that you don't drive yourself mad. Another thing. When you educate bad players, like let's say a bad player makes a mistake. I saw one last night when I was playing that a guy checked a full house on the river from up front. Like, he checked the turn when he made his full house, and then he checked again the river to try and maybe check raise the river or something. Yeah, it was a bad play. Totally. And someone else noted that and said, wow, you should, like, probably bet the river. What benefit is it to you to tell them what they should or should not do? What do you get out of that? What do you get about teaching a bad player a correct play? Does that give you any edge whatsoever? If you're answering yes to yourself, you're either not thinking about this correctly at all, or I don't know, you have an ego problem. And I'm keeping this real with some of my friends who do this and who do listen. You know, when you think about it, there is absolutely no reason to educate. You are literally costing yourself money when you educate a bad player. And here's why. Say that player realizes that and then makes a value bet correctly on the turn or the river in his next session. That's a mistake he no longer makes. That's a mistake he may never make again. Or it's a mistake he'll make much less frequently than he normally did. Congratulations, you just cost yourself part of your win rate because a bad player has corrected a mistake that they wouldn't have made, or they would not have corrected if you had not pointed it out. I see this all the time, and it drives me up the wall. That's like saying, let's say you're Roger Federer, okay, in his prime. He's my favorite athlete in the world, by the way. All the respect to him. Just a little fun fact about him. I love Roger Federer. But let's say you're Roger Federer, okay? And you're playing Andy Murray in a Wimbledon final or Australian Open, whatever. You're playing him in a major final. You're up two sets to none or two sets to love. And you stop the match midway and say, Andy, This is how you should return my serve. Stop it, dogs. Jesus. This is how you should return my serve. This is how you should defend against my forehand. AKA, this is how you should actually beat me. You're saying that everyone would say that's ludicrous, right? Why would he ever do that? That's exactly my point. Why would you do that? In a poker game against bad players, why in the hell would you do that? It makes absolutely no sense. Stop educating the people you're making money from. Not only is it going to hurt you, by the way, it hurts my win rate if I'm against a bad player. It drives me absolutely in the wall. And now some of you can hit back at me and say, well, Curtis, why are you making a podcast? And that's a fair point. But I concede this to a point that if you're trying to get better, then that's different. If you're a bad player who wants to get better, and someone asks me, they know I'm a good player, and they say, hey, I'm trying to learn this. Well, especially if they're a friend, or even if they're somebody I just genuinely respect and I like, yeah, why not? Am I just going to be a douche and just say, no, learn on your own? And you could argue that's not you being a douche, that's forcing them to take the same route you did to get better, but it just depends on the person you are. I'm a nice person. I'm a friendly guy. I like having good relationships with people, and I love talking poker. I love talking poker so much that I've made a podcast myself for talking poker. And if that's what someone wants to do, if they want to get better, then hey, by all means, I'll be happy. And they can listen to this, or they can talk poker with me, or they can go to whatever training site that I recommend them to, or read whatever book. And that's cool. That's fine. But if they're not actively searching for a way to get better, I'm not going to tell them about this podcast. This is, you know, people who listen to this are people who enjoy poker, who I think are kind of have an interest in getting better, in being good players. And, you know, you all are taking this journey along with me. And maybe this will help inspire somebody else who can show them the ropes on, you know, if they decide to become a professional and they see what it took for me to get there, you know, and it gives me experience in podcasting and in broadcasting, which both are areas of work that I absolutely love. So that's my counter argument to you. If no one's actively looking to get better, then that's not my market. My market is the people who want to learn what it takes to become a professional, if they want to get better, if they want to relate to poker and see how it really is. Get a real behind the view of how it really takes to grind your way to live professional stakes, as opposed to all the glamorous shit that they see on ESPN and the World Series of Poker, because that shit's just not real, or at least for a lot of people. It's not like that for everybody. It's like that for very few. I kind of touched on this already, but the next thing I wanted to talk about was ego. If you have an ego problem, then, and you just can't help yourself, just go ahead and accept the fact that you're going to be hurting your win rate by educating or by trying to or openly talk about how much better you are than somebody else. You remember in the first episode when I said I brought my poker books to a game with me? That's probably what it was. It was probably like a little ego thing that I did. Was a, like, ooh, I've got poker books. I'm learning. Are you guys learning? Maybe that was a little subconscious ego thing I had. Can I say that I think I am a better poker player than 95% of people who play cash games? I can think that. I think I can comfortably say yes. But is that because of ego, or is that just based on fact? Like, because I study so much, that I put in a certain amount of hours, that I have a good win rate, that I've won so much. I have evidence to back that up, not to boost my ego, but just to say, that's just like comparing resumes in any profession. I've worked harder than this other person who hasn't worked as hard, and I've been able to win consistently and get invited back to games. I don't think that's necessarily ego. I think that at that point it's just a fact. But it's, you have to be able to consciously separate the two. Do I openly talk about it in a game? No. Because again, if you're going to intimidate somebody, they might A, try and get better to try and meet your skill level, B, they might not enjoy it as much anymore and leave, or C, maybe it has no effect at all. But that's only one out of three options where things stay the same, like if somebody just doesn't care. Otherwise, they're either going to get better or they're not going to play there anymore because they don't enjoy playing with you. I'm really good with, and some people can definitely back this up. What I like to do when I go to games is I love to talk it up. I love to make people feel comfortable. It's more fun for me. It's more fun for them. I think the environment is more fun. I think people get less angry on bad beats. I think they tend to enjoy themselves more. So it's a more relaxing environment for everyone. And this is how I've been able to always get invited back to home games. I make friends. This isn't like a scheme. This is just a way that I maneuver. This is how people like to play with me. Even though people probably know that I'm a good player, they like to play with me because I'm a fun guy to be around, because I'm friendly. And I think this is what truly good No Limit Cash Game players do. They do little things like this. Okay? They think about it beyond strategy, because I've seen evidence of a guy who was really good at a 2-5 game that, probably better than me, to be honest, in terms of skill. I mean, significantly. I mean, this guy was a really, really, really good player. But he was such a jackass. He was such an asshole that he was bitching and complaining all the time. And he had massive entitlement tilt, too, that they just stopped inviting him back. He literally started to hurt the game because people didn't want to play with him anymore. I think this is extreme. Like, one of my friends who I play with here in Virginia is just kind of known for his outbursts, and they're really funny. But I think he recognizes that. He's not, like, throwing insults around. But if you're a jackass consistently all the time and you think things need to be run the way you want them to, then you can hurt your chances at coming back to a game, because I've seen it happen to a really, really good player who cost himself a seat in a really good game because he was such a jackass, because he had so much ego. So leave that shit at the door. Berating, I kind of throw this in the same. It's just kind of a sub. What's the word I'm looking for? Kind of like a subtopic in ego. You're either going to run a player away, they're going to not like you, or they're going to get better, or maybe a combination of all of these, or some of these. There's no upside. They're either going to get better, cost your win rate. They're going to leave, cost your win rate. They're going to not like you. You know, they might play back at you in a certain way now, and you don't really know what to do, and you have to adjust. Or a combination of these, and all of these are going to hurt your win rate. There's just no upside. Don't do it. Just stop yourself. Just think about this. Next time you want to berate, next time you want to get angry at somebody, just stop and think about this. Just say, is it worth it? What do I get out of berating? What do I get about whining about my bad beat? What do I get out of it? The answer is nothing. You get nothing. To quote Willy Wonka, you lose. You get nothing. Entitlement, I already touched on, but I want to reemphasize one final point before we wrap up. This is especially important in a home game because you have a limited player pool. This is not a casino where you can go and there's 10, 15 games running of your stake of choosing and you can, you know, berate and there's going to always be people there. In a home game, if you run players away, you're either going to not get invited back or they're going to start to leave. Both hurt your win rate. Games may run less frequently. I've seen this happen as a result of... This was in Kentucky when I was at University of Louisville, of a host just being a poor host and just kind of being entitled to, well, I bought you guys this stuff, so, you know, you're good. And this game did not last long. It lasted a couple months and that game broke and he was never able to run a game again because he was a jackass. So whether you're hosting, whether you're playing, it's important to be nice to people, not only just to be nice because I think it's a more pleasant environment, but for your income and for your game itself. It is so important. It's key. It's vital. Because if you don't have a casino near you and your poker income is coming from home games that you play in, then you better do your damnedest to make sure that this shit survives, to make sure that that game is running as much as possible. So keep that in mind at all times. All right. I think that's going to wrap it up for today. Sorry that hand review took way, way, way longer than I planned. It ran like 20 minutes over what I planned on discussing. But I did give you a pretty detailed look at how I think about hands. And we'll discuss more about that. I have an interesting concept that I do want to discuss next week in relation to... poker. I might dip a little bit into poker strategy, but there is a concept away from the table that I have learned. It's about balance, about balancing your life away from the table. That is going to make things key to being a successful poker player and making sure that you have a life outside of it. I think it's important to do that. So we're going to touch on that next week, along with, I'm sure we'll review one more hand, maybe a couple. Let me know what you thought of the hand review, if you'd like to see more hands posted on the show, if you'd like more poker strategy, if you'd like more life concepts, which we didn't really touch on today, then let me know. Post your comments below the episode post on the Facebook page when it goes up. All right, that's going to do it. You've listened to another episode of the Semi-Pro Poker Show. We've made it one step closer to becoming a professional. And thank you for listening, and I will see you in the next week. All right, have a good day. Bye-bye.